From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. Starting off the show today with an interesting conversation about how businesses are finding their way back in, do we call it a post-COVID world yet? I think maybe not yet, but at least a post-COVID restrictions world. Joining me in this segment is Nick Rausch. He is the owner of Rausch Rentals. He's also the president of the North La Crosse Business Association. Nick, welcome back to Newsmakers.
Thanks, Ezra. I appreciate you having me on.
Always a pleasure to talk to you and to get your perspective on the challenges that have been facing the business community and how at what different people are doing to kind of dig out of it. So speaking of that, this has been a really, really difficult year for La Crosse area businesses. Talk about what your members in the North La Crosse Business Association and maybe you yourself as a business owner are experiencing and have experienced over the last 14 months?
Well, I think if I look at where people are at today, a lot of business owners are excited and I think cautiously optimistic at the world clamoring to reengage with the economy, right? When we, especially we look at through the lens, I think North La Crosse Business Association, I think La Crosse in general, where small business really makes up the fabric of a community. Like part of what makes a city or a place great are those great places to eat or the great place to do the thing or the arts, performing, you know, all the different things that make up this fabric of the community. And when you really step back and look at it, all those things are directly correlated to small business. So I think lots of our members, lots of our local businesses are super excited about that re-engagement. I think there's a massive amount of pent-up demand on the public side where people are excited and over-eager maybe or extremely eager to re-engage with their lives. They're dying to get out because we're social animals and we need each other. So there's just a truth to that, right? And so I think that's what I see happening today. And of course, there's lots of challenges that come with that. I'm sure we'll have a chance to chat about those things. If I look back on where we've been, well, it's a long story. How much time do we have? I would say that everybody started out with, where's this going, right? If we rewind the clock, 15 months, it was, where's this going? What is it that we can trust in? And something, a point that I brought up early on is before or as we embark on this adventure with some level of trust on how it's going to work out, what are the metrics by which we're going to know all clear, that we're going to know we're done? And of course, I never got an answer to that question, right? And that's how, 2 weeks to flatten the curve turns into 15 months to flatten everybody. And that's a challenging thing to negotiate, right? Because as we've chatted about, how do you balance all these competing interests of what's going on? And so the toughest part for so many businesses was we've been in this place of we're in lockdown. We don't know an endpoint. There are no metrics by which the endpoint can be understood right now. We're pouring money into the situation, losing it faster than we can pour it in. And so now what? And that presented a huge amount of challenges for our membership in what do we do? How can we plan when there is no plan? And when we can't see the bottom, what do we do to accommodate for that?
Well, and this is not just theoretical on your part, because you personally, you and your wife are the owners. In addition to owning Rausch Rentals, you also own Root Down Yoga, which is a local yoga studio in North La Crosse. I mean, it's fair to say that business was almost lost because of the pandemic. Talk about that.
Well, without question, we taught our last in-person classes at the studio on St. Patrick's Day of 2020. And we didn't reopen the studio for in-person classes until the day after St. Patrick's Day, a year later. So we were closed to in-person classes for a year. And, the short story is we lost a huge amount of money throughout that context of that year trying to figure out, because even as you close down operations, there's lots of bills that keep coming. Mortgages and insurance and, point of sale and the internet service, things that you can't turn off because you don't know if you need to turn back on the next day. And, you know, the short version is, if not for the other business that we were engaged in, my wife and I would be bankrupt right now. You know, it's only through other resources that we were able to keep things afloat and for us personally and to be able to reopen the business, which I'm incredibly grateful for. And at the same time, you know, our situation is somewhat unique in that we had this other thing to help bolster our life when I know dozens of business owners personally who did not and have either lost their business, lost their houses, you know, not sure how they're going to pay for kids' college or whatever the thing might be, because, you know, they continue to double down and put more and more money in on this downward slope without an endpoint and without that end in sight. So, you know, I'm grateful that we were able to navigate what we have. And yet I've seen the situation of a lot of my peers where they didn't have that other resource. And that's super challenging. I don't mean to be Debbie Downer, but this is a Roger reality. You know, that's
yeah, no, this has been a really difficult year.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So you mentioned before we went on the air, you and I had a chance to talk for a little bit. And you were talking about an opportunity that your membership had to just be together and express the various difficulties, the lessons learned, the challenges. You even said some of them were talking about the silver linings of what it's been like through the last year. What struck you about those conversations that you were able to have with your membership?
What struck me the most is that just indomitable human spirit. And I'm also going to say Midwest resilience, right? Like, it gets cold around here. People are tough. You know, they will buck up and do the thing if they can, right? If they can see a way, find a way, they will try. And so the thing that I was so struck with in that meeting was I was inspired by people's resilience, their desire to find a way to survive and make something work, if at all possible. And then when I look at silver linings, I think that what went down gave lots of people cause to find new ways to engage with their customers, right? So, you know, maybe it pulled some people kicking and screaming into the digital age, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. And it was a trial by fire, but many people learned a ton of things from that. So that happened. I think some folks found ways to be more efficient because the amount of demands for their time only went up because everything just got harder to get done. And so they found ways to be more efficient with their time. And I think that was a big silver lining. When I look at the challenges and things that I hear about what's going on, the number one thing that I'm hearing right now is manpower. Almost every employer in the room was desperate for employees, hiring, signing bonuses for dishwashers at restaurants, right? And the other big concern is, that I heard was sort of a combination of taxes and cost of resources. So we've got some pretty substantial inflation at play right now in lots of industries. And then lots of folks that are really concerned about what's happening with taxes in the midst of recovery. You know, we've already seen some things come out of City Hall and La Crosse in the form of, once again, another big bump in lots of assessments. And so that has an immediate tax penalty that comes along with it while people are in the midst of recovery. And then we've also got people, you know, concerned with the cost of the goods that they sell. You know, the price of beef has doubled for the restaurants, right, in the context of the last few weeks. For me in the real estate business, the cost of lumber is up anywhere from 300 to 500%, which destroys projects. It just makes them stop because the end value doesn't offset the cost. So those are the kind of the brief overview of the things I've heard and the challenge that I see.
You talked about at the very beginning of our conversation, you talked about the difficulty, the way you put it, I think was, you know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve became 15
months to flatten everybody.
15 months to flatten everybody. And your particular comment there was about the lack of measurable metrics that were known from the beginning that would mark, you know, the end of the shutdown of businesses and that kind of thing. What do you wish had been done differently in that vein, or maybe if there's something else that comes to mind, what you know, not so much lessons learned by individual businesses, but as a society or as the government or whatever, what do you wish had been handled differently with 2020 hindsight?
So here's the thing for me is, as I, and this is my hope for society at large, right, is whenever something really big and let's call it catastrophic goes down, my hope is that we have the courage to look back in hindsight and go, okay, here's the things we really got right, and here's the things we really got wrong, such that when this occurs again, how can we make better choices next time to make maybe our compromises less impactful, right? Or impactful in a good way and less harmful, right? Less unintended consequence, let's put it that way. So what I would wish for in hindsight is that we paid attention to the metrics that I think would have affected outcome the most. The most critical metrics is, in this, looking at it in hindsight, are probably two things: hospital capacity and mortality. Like, those are probably the two most critical metrics. Beyond that, in looking at those things, how can we examine those metrics on a relatively localized basis to know how that affects what's happening in our local, and I'm going to use the word economy, but really our local community, because it affects schools, it affects business, it affects, you know, people's perceptions, their fears, all of those things. And so that's kind of my hope, is that we're paying attention to the metrics that matter most, and that we're trying to err on the side of as much freedom as possible for everyone's benefit, keeping in mind the risks that are associated with it. Because I think it's one of the things that I learned this year is that a lot of folks have a hard time understanding comparative risk, meaning my comparative risk to turn the key in my car and drive to work or drive my kids to work or whatever, versus my comparative risk of contracting COVID and it being a mortal danger to me. And so those are the things that I'm hoping we can do next time, if that makes sense.
Your membership is, well, let me just ask you, how many members are there at the North La Crosse Business Association? I know you've got a bunch of businesses.
And growing. It was interesting. We took on the Get On Living Safely campaign. It was our project for 2020. And we raised over $70,000 in peer-to-peer money coming in to help grow awareness of small business and our importance of small business community and re-engaging with the economy. And it was incredibly successful. We reached over 40,000 people in the context of that. And so our membership is growing. And it seems like it's maybe even growing beyond North La Crosse, because so many folks are excited about the things that we're doing. But that's kind of an overview of where we've been there and who we are.
When you talk, when you talk about the difficult year that's behind us, are there businesses, you talked about watching, you know, people whose businesses didn't make it. Are there places that were, you know, prominent to members of the public, names that they would recognize of places that aren't there anymore?
I think the things that we saw that aren't there anymore mostly was on the restaurant side. We saw the new noodle bar downtown, the Fat Porcupine close. We saw about a half a dozen other restaurants, so I won't go through and list it, close. The things that were hit the most were the service industries, right? Where that human-to-human contact was super high. And so we saw restaurants get hurt. We saw in-person contact business get hurt. We saw small retail get hurt and some of those places not being able to reopen. And what we've seen the most on our side is the hospitality industry, service industry, all of those companies, they're just have borrowed themselves into indentured servancy at this point. So I think they've got a capacity for survival as tourism and life wakes up again. But, you know, speaking from our own experience, the hole that we dug will take 5 or 6 years of things going right just to get back to even, right? Like just to get back to where we were. So we saw businesses close. We saw people get hurt. And then we saw people just double and triple down on debt in the interest of being able to keep their business afloat because, you know, that's their business. They don't have a plan B, right? That's what they do.
The last time we talked, it was in reference to the to the program that you just mentioned, Get On Living Safely. And and you mentioned during that conversation the importance of focusing on area small businesses rather than sinking your money into various kinds of delivery services and that sort of thing. Do you think that message is being bought in Greater La Crosse? Do you think our community is how do you think our community is doing at that?
I think our community has responded to it really well, and I see people excited to reengage with small business in a way that I haven't seen in a while because of it. People are dying for that human-to-human contact, that, you know, touch it, try it on, meet the person who's selling it to me. There's a desire and a demand for that that I'm seeing being very renewed because of folks' desire for human contact. What I will say, Ezra, is that message, especially on the retail side, where it's not a human contact business, where it's a retail business, that's not a service industry business, that message isn't going away and can't go away, right? And, you know, my ongoing joke is that, you know, and I can show you a picture of any one of the hallways of our apartment buildings that are filled with Amazon packages on the daily, right? And when COVID happened, the packages doubled like a light switch, right? And then my ongoing joke is that I'm fairly sure that Amazon and Jeff Bezos is not going to show up with a truck full of money to help La Crosse, Wisconsin. Like, I'm reasonably confident that's not going to happen. So I'm hoping that that message continues to resonate, not from a place of like, you know, negative Nancy, but from a place of as community members, you have an opportunity to invest in your friends and neighbors' jobs when you choose to spend locally, right? Like, you're helping your neighbor out when you do that. And you're keeping that local business alive so that when you need that local thing, it's there for you. And so I'm seeing that it's a win. And I'm seeing that with overwhelming positive feedback to this day from the consumer side.
So help somebody. I'm not great at math, so maybe help me understand. I kind of get it though. Like, I spend money at a big box store, or I spend it at a little shop on Caledonia Street. I'm spending the same amount of money. Sometimes I might be spending more at the little shop on Caledonia Street.
Right.
But I understand that I'm sustaining people's jobs. But I'm sustaining people's jobs locally, whichever store I shop at. So at what point do you see the compounded value of that local, of that dollar being spent locally over and over and over again?
Well, in rough percentages, if you buy something at a locally owned and operated store, about 70% of your dollar stays in the community for the first turn, and meaning for the first re-spend. And then theoretically, that turn lasts about seven times as it diminishes down, right? If you spend money in an online store, at best, about 10% of that money happens locally, really only in the form of sales tax and state taxes, right? So that's the percentage difference. And I'll give this little example from like our little spot on Caledonia Street. Let's say, for example, you walk into the bike store and you buy a new bicycle. Well, now the person that sold you that bicycle can afford to walk right across the street and buy a watch for his wife at the jewelry store. And the person that works at the jewelry store can walk down the street and have lunch at the cafe. And then the person who waits tables at the cafe can go upstairs and take a yoga class. And the person that teaches the yoga class can go and take their kids down the street to the music and friends classes at Bebop and Bundles. And then the people that do that, and on and on and on, right? So
I just want to know who's bringing me a chocolate malt from the sweet shop.
Yes. Yes. Right. Sweet shop, perfect example. So the point is, as soon as that money goes out of town, it never comes back.
Okay.
Right. And as soon as you spend that money at Amazon, poof, it's gone. Like, there's no more revenue for La Crosse, the person that owns this, the person that owns that, and not just the person that owns that store, but all the people that work at those stores. We forget that this is actually true. Over 90% of the businesses in America are small business, right? Over 90% of the businesses are small business. And we employ more people than big business as a whole. And so it's that fabric, right? You're helping your friends and neighbors when that happens. And as soon as you spend that money online, it never comes home. It's gone forever.
Nick Roush is our guest today. And Nick, I've really enjoyed our conversation. He's with Roush Rentals, Root Down Yoga, and also the president of the North La Crosse Business Association. Nick, thank you very much for your perspective.
Ezra, it's been a pleasure. So enjoy you having me on, and I hope we get a chance to talk again soon.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to hear about some nonprofit organizations that are working together and helping to make a difference in our community. And we'll also talk about the plight of nonprofit organizations who really need those operating funds to get going, and how one local organization is lending a helping hand toward that effort. That's all coming up. If you'd like to hear part of our conversation with Nick Roush again, you can find it online. It's at wpr.org/newsmakers. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you very much for joining us today. Earlier in the show, talking a little bit about how some area businesses are getting going now that some of our COVID-19 restrictions, most of them actually, are being lifted throughout our area now that vaccine is widely available and lots of people are getting that. And so it's interesting to hear about how the business community is getting back going. Another group of people who have really struggled over the last year are nonprofits, who many of them have a hard enough time making it in a normal year. And with COVID-19, they've just been really thrown for a loop. And so we've been talking about that as the year goes on. And here's another opportunity to talk about a really interesting aspect of nonprofit life that I don't know if many of our listeners may be aware of. And that is the difficulty that they get getting not only grant funding, but grant support that they're allowed to use toward operating costs like rent and salaries and those kinds of things. Everybody wants their donated dollar to be used as effectively as possible, and that's a great goal. Your salaries still need to be paid, and rent still needs to be paid, and the lights still need to be kept on. So we're talking with some people related to that issue right now. Joining us are Sister Julie Tidrick from the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Sister Julie, thank you very much for your time today.
Welcome.
Also joining me is Tita Utick from the Family and Children's Center. Tita, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
A familiar voice to a lot of our listeners is Jamie Schlegel from the La Crosse Community Foundation. Jamie, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me again, Ezra.
Absolutely. And we're talking in particular about the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration have agreed to basically a multi-year deal where they're going to be providing some much-needed operating help to Family and Children's Center. So let's start with Sister Julie and talk about why this was such an important project for the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration to get involved in.
Well, most of all, we're fond of helping wherever help is needed. So that's our mission. And we're well acquainted with grants that only let people do certain things like capital campaigns and really exciting and very interesting, unique new projects. But we're well acquainted as a nonprofit ourselves that all of those things that you just mentioned, Ezra, need to be paid, the rent, the lights, the payrolls. And so having been on their board, I knew that sometimes the cash flow timing was an issue. Sometimes the county contract funding didn't come in time to pay the payroll, so they would have to dip into their line of credit to cover the payroll. And of course, that's a more expensive way to keep the bills paid on time. So that's why one of the reasons I thought about, we need to do this grant. We need to apply and see if we can get some help flowing. But we also understand endowments in terms of you want to grow some money on money that you can put away, because the money you grow is the easiest money you make. But the operation has to go, otherwise the doors have to close.
Tita, let's focusing on the Family and Children's Center right now. If people are unfamiliar, start by telling us a little bit about what you do and sort of the scope of your mission.
Family and Children's Center has been in our community since 1881. And through that time, we've grown to two states. We're in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. We are in five communities and we have seven different sites. We operate over 30 programs, providing services along a continuum of care. So we work with children, families, and individuals, helping them become the best version of themselves. Those 30 programs that we operate include things like prevention programming, early intervention programming, and treatment programming. So it's just a little bit of something about ourselves.
So when you look over the last year and two or three months, the challenges that face an organization like yours at the best of times can be daunting. What has the last year or so been like for the Family and Children's Center?
It's absolutely been crazy, Ezra, right? But the whole world was crazy and impacted, and we were no different, certainly. We had funding challenges for sure each and every day from the beginning of the pandemic through to the end, and it's still ongoing. And we had to find ways to continue to work with our clients while keeping the clients safe and our staff safe as well. And those were huge challenges for us. We have school, alternative school programming that had to shutter services for a while we figured out how to keep everybody safe. But, you know, I'm really proud that through the pandemic, we kept our doors open, figuratively, working with all of our clients, making sure that the most vulnerable clients in our community continued to have services being administered to them, if you will. But we had to pivot very quickly. We had to navigate the online virtual community and how do we keep clients safe and our staff safe when we're doing intensive in-home visiting programs to our most vulnerable and at-risk parents and children. And so it's been a challenge, but with that grew many opportunities for us. And we were very resilient, and I'm really proud of the work we did through the pandemic.
Sister Julie, I want to come back to you because we haven't talked about the particulars of the grant that you're making to the Family and Children's Center. It wouldn't surprise people that an organization like that takes a lot of overhead to run every single month. And the grant that you're offering is, I want to get the numbers right. It's $10,000 a month, right, for a period of time. Talk about the particulars of that arrangement.
We just allotted and went for $10,000 a month for 3 years toward the operating expenses to help keep the bills paid and not have to hit the line of credit. And then we put the rest, asked for that to be placed in the endowment fund where it could grow more money, because we know Family and Children's Center is allowed to draw the interest off the endowment each year.
And establishing an endowment fund like that is where someone like the La Crosse Community Foundation comes in. A lot of different funds exist within that foundation. Jamie Schlegel with the La Crosse Community Foundation, talk a little bit about why it's such a challenge to educate donors about why it's important not to just exclude operating funds from their philanthropic giving.
Sure. You started to touch on it a bit in your introduction that as donors, I would include myself in this, we want the treasures that we give to support charitable organizations to be used for what they're most needed and to have the greatest impact. And so over time, the pressure has been built up, certainly for nonprofit leaders and organizations to try to deliver their missions with the thinnest margins as possible. And what that has really led to is something called the nonprofit starvation cycle. Unlike for-profit businesses, nonprofits haven't been able to reinvest in themselves to take care of their facilities if they own one, which often nonprofits who own their own facilities are in a better financial situation than others, depending on mission type. To recruit and retain quality staff who have the skills and talent needed to deliver the services related to their mission, to keep up with IT, to not have furnishings that they're embarrassed of when people walk in the door. And so it's a great learning opportunity that I've certainly embraced in the donors and fund holders that I work with at the Community Foundation, that anytime someone comes to me and says, I only want to support organizations that have the lowest overhead, I actually say, well, let's talk about that a little bit and talk about why you should really want to support organizations that have a healthy overhead. Because A, if an organization tells you they have no overhead, they either don't know how to manage their finances correctly, or they're flat out lying to you, or they're not meeting all of the, certainly a lot of the legal and regulatory compliance rules that are out there. So it's just, it's that starvation cycle has really grown for organizations. It's become real. And now I'm fortunate that there's opportunities like this to try to debunk that myth and help people understand, just like a for-profit business, nonprofits have to operate effectively and efficiently too.
Jamie, you talked about overhead and people wanting to donate to organizations with the lowest overhead. And I can't help but think about, like, around the holidays, we always see these things passed around, especially as people want to give something at maybe Christmas time, or maybe include something in their year-end giving. All these debunked claims about huge national and international nonprofit organizations and the supposedly enormous salaries that their CEOs earn, and all these different things. But then various resources are available from governments and others around our state and other states that look at financial documents from these organizations, and people who don't necessarily know what they're looking at have access to a ton of information about all these organizations. What kind of numbers should we as donors be looking at? What percentage is appropriate? You talked about the difference between low overhead and appropriate overhead. How do we know the difference?
It depends on the organization and the type of services that they're delivering. So it wouldn't be fair to me to put out a specific range, you know, of this percentage to this percentage. What I encourage our donors to do is to talk with their favorite organizations that they're interested in investing with and ask them, what is your overhead rate? What's included in that? Why is it set up to be that way? How does that improve your operations? And the way that you're able to successfully deliver your mission. And as a donor, if you're comfortable with that and you fully understand that, you know, then hopefully a high overhead or a too low overhead is no longer one of the leading determining factors in whether or not you choose to support something.
Tita Utuck with the Family and Children's Center. As you've talked to donors over the years, either through your work at the Family and Children's Center or through your previous work, and you've kind of had to sell the message to them. It's not lost on me that you know, donors want to use phrases like, I want my money to go directly to the cause, or whatever. But your buildings are part of the cause. Your people are part of the cause. Talk about selling that message to potential donors.
You know, the best way I can do that is something that Jamie had said. It's about educating our donors and telling them, what does overhead mean? And we really talk about it in terms of, instead of looking at overhead and basing the decision on overhead, but kind of looking at the impact that our nonprofit makes and how effective we are, and trying to change and shift the conversation a little bit to help them understand what it is they're giving to, how effective we are, and why it's important, why we matter in this community, and what services we provide, and what, you know, we're dealing with social issues on a massive scale, right? And so our ability to address those issues is based on our ability to keep our doors open. And so we talk about that. And it's an education. And I think our donors in this community are savvy donors, and the philanthropic community is. And I think they want to learn, and they're open to those conversations. So I'm happy to have those conversations, and we have, and really shifting towards how effective we are and the impact we have on the community, I think really helps shape that conversation.
What does that impact look like in terms of what kind of numbers do you want people to know in terms of your work? Is it fair to put it down to like how many people you're able to serve, or how do you judge a successful outcome in your line of work?
So in our world, there's a number of ways. Behavioral health organizations haven't always done it really well, right? And we're behind maybe the for-profit world where they're crunching numbers all the time. But we do a really good job here at Family and Children's Center. We look at our outcomes and we measure them on a quarterly basis. And for example, it does in part include how many, the impact of our organization. So how many people we serve in a year. And last year it was about 3,500 people, right? So we look at that. We look at our outcomes related to treatment foster care, for example, that 97% of our kids leave treatment foster care and go to less restrictive environments. We look at our healthy families program, our intensive home visiting program, and we know that 94% of those families take their children to healthy visit exams and whatnot. We look at the impact our other door community has, our program has in the Vernon County community, providing over 5,000 mental health and sobriety peer support groups. So every one of our programs have outcomes attached to it. And we look at each of those and we're able to report out on them quarterly and annually so that we can talk about the impact our organization has within the community and with our clients.
You've just talked about so many different kinds of efforts that your program is involved in. I think people hear Family and Children's Center and think that it must be, you know, some kind of orphanage or something like that. What kind of services do you provide that people might be the most surprised by?
Oh, let's see. We have a residential facility for adults with severe and persistent mental illness. And I don't know if people know a lot about that. We have alternative education programs. We have one of our largest programs is with adults with severe and persistent mental health challenges, keeping them within our communities. We have outpatient mental health counseling. We work with intensive home visiting, the Healthy Families Program. We work with youth transitioning out of foster care. So it really is a continuum of services we provide. Again, that prevention all the way to treatment programming and everywhere in between. So we are not a boutique organization. We do a lot of different things, and we have to raise a lot of money, and we need a lot of friends in the community to help support our efforts to do that.
We are talking to Tita Utuck from the Family and Children's Center, also Jamie Schlegel from the La Crosse Community Foundation, and Sister Julie Chidrick from the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. And we're talking specifically about a gift that the sisters have offered to the Family and Children's Center that allows them to cover quite a lot of operating costs. We've been talking about the importance of allowing grantors to help cover those operating costs because of how difficult it is for nonprofits to raise them. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like more information about Newsmakers, perhaps you'd like to stream part of this conversation that you've missed or a previous episode that you might not have been able to hear yet, you can find them all on our website. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. I'd love to hear from you if you have an idea for a future show or a question about how the show operates or somebody you'd like us to get a hold of. You can send me an email at newsmakers@WPR.org. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, where our Southwestern Regional Office is located. Thank you very much for tuning in today. We're talking to Sister Julie Tidrick from the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, Tita Utuck from the Family and Children's Center, and Jamie Schlegel from the La Crosse Community Foundation. And we've been talking about a generous ongoing contribution from the sisters, $10,000 a month toward the operating expenses of the Family and Children's Center, and some money toward their endowment as well. And Sister Julie, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration have been involved in the La Crosse area for, you know, more years than me or my parents or my grandparents have been alive and have made such a difference for so many different people. Talk about, I don't know if it's a recent change, but it seems like nonprofit organizations across our community are really focusing on more social justice type issues and the needs of people who might find themselves sort of out on the fringes of society. And I think that's a good thing to be drawing more attention to those kinds of needs. Why are those areas such an important part of the focus of FSPA in recent years?
Mainly because of the story in the gospel that says, take care of the poor, tend to the widow, watch out for the orphan. And so we look for those categories in today's society. They have different names. Some of them are into addiction, some are into homelessness, but they are the ones we need to care for, and they are the ones that are most ignored. So raising funds for them and, you know, entertaining people volunteering with them is part of our goal.
A lot of people who know you as a Catholic organization might not understand why it's so important to you to reach beyond the walls of your church, so to speak. Why is it important to you to reach out into so many different areas of the community?
Mainly because of the example that Jesus set for us. Jesus did not start a church, so to speak. We did that after he was dead and gone. And the needs keep mushrooming and they keep showing up in front of us. And we have to stay attentive and be watchful and recognize them when we find them.
Jamie Schlegel from the La Crosse Community Foundation, we touched a little bit on the idea that your organization would be a place where something like an endowment might exist or where other donor-advised funds are in play. Talk about the work of the Community Foundation and kind of a little bit more specifically about what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Cross Community Foundation is actually one of the oldest community foundations in the United States. We will be celebrating our 91st birthday in July. The first community foundation was started in Ohio in 1914, and some very smart folks who preceded all of us on this call today said La Crosse needs one of these. So back in 1930, it was actually the La Crosse County Bar Association. So our legacy spans not quite as long as Family and Children's Center or the FSPA, but we are quite a neat historical triad here on this call for La Crosse. We exist to connect folks in the community who are passionate about supporting charitable needs with organizations who are addressing those charitable needs. So we help folks set up mostly endowment funds that they can support while they're living, and then we'll continue to steward on their behalf when they're no longer with us. And those funds will exist forever to continue to support what was important to them and to leave and build this world into a better place for future generations. Last year in 2020, we managed 289 funds. That's the number as of today. And last year we gave away a little over $4.5 million from those funds. So we are the largest regular grant maker in the community. And you were talking about nonprofit needs increasing because of the pandemic, and that was certainly something that we watched and why last year we gave away $1 million more than we normally would to be responsive to the community needs, because that really is a part of our core purpose, is to be able to adapt to what's happening in the nonprofit world today and leveraging our resources and donors to help meet those needs.
Somebody might listen to you talking about the Community Foundation, and they might even be familiar with some of the grants that some of your funds have provided over the years. And they might think, oh, that's well and good for rich people, but I'm not rich. I can't become involved in something like that. But I know people who are, who, like, when I used to be a paperboy, Like some of the people on my paper route who have now passed on have left funds with the community foundation. What talk about how, you know, how like a regular, like middle class person can make such a lasting difference.
That is who we exist to serve. Generally, the wealthiest folks will have their own foundation. They'll establish their own infrastructure to be able to administer their charity, whether that's during their lifetime or afterwards. And we really exist to help anyone, regardless of capacity to give, be able to do the same thing. And we use our scalability as a way to make that an option for anybody. So there actually is no minimum to start a fund at the community foundation. And a fund does have to have $10,000 in it before it can start making grants. But you can take a decade to get to that point. And then we invest gifts. And so just like Sister Julie was talking about earlier, those gifts continue to give on forever. And your gifts are multiplied. So it really is what I call the magic of compound interest.
So
that makes endowment so wonderful.
So an individual person can establish a charitable fund at the community foundation, but an organization like a 501c3 organization can also establish, they can put their endowment in a place like yours. How many of the accounts that you manage, just, I mean, you don't have to get into specifics in terms of who's who, but like how many of them would you say are like based on an individual person's desire to give, and how many of them are based on an organization's need to have some place to help build their endowment?
Of our 289 funds we have today, 26 are agency endowment funds. So that means they were started by the agency themselves to support themselves. So one of those 26 is one of Family and Children Center's endowments. They have several. The rest are what I call donor-directed funds. So that means when they were established, either the donor or the organization, whoever it was, said, this is what I want the fund to be used to support. And then it's our job to make that happen perpetually.
As we close our conversation today, I want to make sure that everybody knows how to get in touch with everybody else. Jamie, you talked about all of the members of this call being in the community for a long time. I'll add Wisconsin Public Radio to that list that's been on the air for 100 years now, 100 plus two or three, I think. And so I want people to be able to get in touch with the people that they feel like they need to reach. So we'll start with the Family and Children Center. If people feel like they can help your organization, or if they feel like they might need the help of your organization, how do they find information about the Family and Children Center?
Well, probably one of the easiest ways is to certainly go online at fcconline.org. And the other way is to call us at 608-785-0001 and give us a call and tell us what you're looking for, and we'll direct you to the right place.
Sister Julie Tidrick from the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, you do so much in the community through your organization, also through the Franciscan Spirituality Center and all the other types of programs that you offer. How can people find more information about the sisters?
We also have a website online. It's www.fspa.org. And there are many choices you can select there, and people's phone numbers. And if all else fails, look in the phone book, go to St. Rose Convent and ask for the communications department. They'll get you to the right department that will answer your question.
The phone book. I remember those. Jamie Schlegel from the La Crosse Community Foundation. If people are interested in learning more about your work, how do they find it?
We're online, too. The easiest way is to simply Google La Crosse Community Foundation. You'll find our website, phone number, Facebook page, Instagram, lots of ways to connect with us. And we'd love to talk with anyone and answer any questions they may have.
Jamie, thanks for being here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sister Julie, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Tita, thank you for being on Newsmakers.
Thank you so much.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have more information that you'd like to hear from part of this show that you might have missed, or if you'd like to stream a previous episode on demand, you can find them at our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. If you've got an idea for a future program, send it to me. I'd love to hear it. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our show today is produced by Dawn Jewell. Thanks a lot to John Davis for his help as well, and the rest of the lacrosse staff. We're always online, but there are a couple of opportunities to hear us on the air. We originate 10 a.m. on Fridays on 90.3, the Ideas Network. We repeat 7 p.m. on Fridays on NPR News and Music 88.9. For the lacrosse staff of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Ezra Wall. Please join us again next time for another Newsmakers right here on WPR.